would be enough for the whole world to wage another world war.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate 4 new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to 4 more bases. Washington has currently 5 bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
The harsh treatment of the Israeli regime against Palestinian prisoners is continuing unabated. At least 120 Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail are on hunger strike in protest against the regime's repressive measures. The Palestinian Prisoners Society has said the Palestinian political prisoners started the mass strike to protest against the inhumane conditions at Israel's notorious Negev prison.
Ben-Gavir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
The commission said the inmates announced their decision to launch a hunger strike in response to the new repressive measures imposed on them by Israeli prison authorities. The development came after Israeli forces stormed several sections in Megiddo, Ofer, and Negev Desert prisons, attacking Palestinian prisoners and placing a group of them in solitary confinement. The Palestinian resistance factions have warned that the tension in prisons will not stay within their walls. They say harming the prisoners will have repercussions within and outside Israeli prisons.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
Reports say the move is in response to the abuses suffered by inmates in Section 26 and 27 in the Negev, the transfer of others from Section 8 to Section 6 in the same prison, and depriving them of their possessions and basic needs. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held under administrative detention, in which Israel keeps the detainees without charge for up to 6 months, a period which can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. Rights groups describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end this move.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at the illegal detentions. Israeli jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider, and this is Youth Station, by the way. Choo-choo-ka-choo, Youth Station for you.
And here is Sister Asma.
Sister Asma, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you.
Same in here, of course.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Actually, do you remember the last episode we were talking about having a leader in your life?
Mm-hmm.
This episode, we're going to kind of take a step forward from there.
And talk about one of the leaders.
Yeah, Allah, right? The leader, the God, yeah. Our God, our creator, the one who creates and then guides.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really need him? Astaghfirullah Rabbi wa atubu ilayh. I mean, let's discuss this. Do you really need him?
Of course, I do need him. Without him, why am I living then? Then life would lose its meaning.
Now, yeah. Do you think that you've invented God just so that you feel like you have some meaning in your life?
No, I feel his existence. It's not something that I have created to myself.
Look, I grew up in England, right? My teachers were all atheists, pretty much. I was surrounded mm-hmm. by atheists.
Yeah.
They seem to get on fine. They don't need a God to believe in. So why do we feel like we need a God? So, you know, when you go mm-hmm. throughout history, mm-hmm. you see that there has been a fitra in human beings. A fitra, a divine yeah. innate nature, which always drags human beings toward the worship of something
yeah.
throughout history. It's manifested through so many different idols. You can see it in ancient Egypt. You can see it in Greece, in Rome.
Yeah.
You know, it's always been these different types of gods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as civilizations got better and better, you know, more sophisticated.
So that's the first point.
Mm-hmm.
Even those who didn't believe in a special religion, they created a God for themselves. That means intuitively we feel the need for a God.
Yes. Intuitively we do feel this need for God.
Yeah.
Now we use that as an argument to prove God. Look, it's in our nature.
Mm-hmm.
We in our divine innate nature, in
yeah.
fact, in our fitra. But then the opposition, atheists, for example, they'll use the same argument to say, well, it's because of that instinct that we had
mm-hmm.
that we felt the compulsion to create a God, but it's actually just a part of our evolutionary traits.
How that intuition, that desire exists in me, that instinct, how?
I don't know. We're just intellectual beings, and therefore we feel the need to express ourselves through art and through culture. And
so if we are intellectual, then we believe that we have not been created like haphazardly, like out of blue we come to exist.
No, I mean,
there must be a creator.
We could argue that we just, it's an accident. It's a freak of nature. We're freaks of nature. We just happened.
No, it's not that simple. For a human body, if you go through it, just as we're talking intellectually, if we go through it in every single step of a child getting growing in his mother's womb, then you can see miracles.
Mm-hmm.
So these miracles are not going to be done just like a click, whatever.
Mm-hmm. But what we see as miracles, you're right, you're absolutely mm-hmm. right. The baby being grown in the womb and then the way
yeah.
we are created, in fact, everything. Everything is actually a miracle in our eyes,
mm-hmm.
but for atheists, everything is just an accident. Everything is just coincidental.
Well, that's for them, then.
I guess so. Well, what can you really do? It's just this complete opposite way
yeah,
of thinking.
Yeah, لَكُمْ دِينُكُمْ وَلِيَ دِينُ.
Yeah.
I remember a writer's quote. There's a beautiful quote that was very beautiful. Every time that somebody talks to me like this, I usually say that those who want a proof for the existence of Allah, they can never believe in him. Because every day they would say, no, this is just the creation of my mind or uh-huh. whatever,
right.
just a hallucination.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you should believe him with your heart, mm-hmm. I guess, because mm-hmm. there you could see him in your soul
yeah.
and you feel him. That quote was like this way. The writer said, I prefer actually to live in this world and believe that there is a God. And then after I die, I understand that there was no God. Instead yeah. of living in this world, believing in no God. And then after death, I understand that there was a God.
Yeah. Yeah. All you atheists are going to wake up to a very, very traumatic experience
exactly.
after you die.
There's nothing
and for
more
us,
to
you know,
do.
For us, we, if we die, you know, we're good. We're covered. We've got some insurance. Now, this might seem like a very shallow argument, but actually this is one of the arguments that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam used. And the atheist who he was debating with was so shocked by this argument, he actually died.
Wow.
Of shock. Yeah. If you really contemplate about it, because there's only one mm-hmm. way or the other way. There's only two ways about it. If you really contemplate about it, it's life-changing.
Yeah, so just go and contemplate about it, but mm-hmm. don't go so far away.
Mm-hmm.
Just be there.
Yeah.
Let's go for a break and then we'll be back.
We'll be right back after the break, inshallah. Welcome back. So I think we've established that God exists, and it's actually better, intellectually speaking, for us to believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to throw a story at you, actually. You just reminded me of one of my teachers. I think he was a maths teacher or history. I'm not quite sure. I can't remember. But anyway, he was a flagrant, militant atheist, and he was convincing all the kids that, wow, you know, God doesn't exist, right? So I said to him, sir, that's fine, but I just have one question. And he said, yeah, go on. And I said, okay, if I were to tell you that there was this forest, mm-hmm, full of trees, and this forest was very, very, very deep, no civilization had ever gone inside there, no human beings had ever treaded
there. I would love there.
Oh, I know, it sounds like a wonderful place to be. but no human beings, mm-hmm, had ever gone in there.
Even the better.
All on their own, the trees cut themselves down.
Uh-huh.
They erected into beautiful houses, and like this village was created.
Yeah.
Just coincidentally. Would you say that's possible? And he said, no, that's impossible.
Double impossible.
I said, well, that's exactly what you're saying about life, the universe, and everything. That it was created without a creator.
Yeah.
And he was stumped. It was such a simple thing to throw at him.
You returned him his strategy.
He was completely silent, and the whole class erupted, and they were like, oh.
Those moments in the class.
Yeah. So, alhamdulillah, I won that round. Okay, fine, God exists. Ha, all right, fine. Why do we need him as a guide? I'm here now. I'm created.
Yeah, so because the one who has been created would for sure need the creator's advice. And the creator's advice is going to come through the prophets and the holy books. And that's why I have to listen to him as a guide.
Why can't you just listen to your intellect?
My intellect is not enough because I'm a restricted human being. Mm. I have my restrictions. I do not understand every single thing. Mm. Sometimes I can't even understand myself. So much less about the important things that happen around me.
Isn't there a hadith that says that Imam Ali alayhi salam, you think you're only a tiny entity, but within you is the entire universe?
Yes, but you have to have a teacher like Imam Ali alayhi salam to reach that point, you know? As a human being who has a lot of feelings and emotions and, you know, anything can change my mood. Anything can change my thoughts and my decisions. So I am under the effect of many things. If I do not have a guideline, if I do not have a rule book, then I may get lost.
So what we're saying is you need to have Allah as a guide.
Yeah.
Because we don't know enough, basically.
Yes, we don't know enough. If we do not go for him as the one who's going to guide us, then I would be a tiny creature. But if I go according to his rules and then dig deep and then try to improve myself, then yes, I would turn into the tiny thing who has a world inside of herself or himself.
I want to go to something that Hujjatul Islam Qara'ati said. He's one of the great scholars of our time and one of our teachers. He's written a tafsir as well.
Yeah.
He was asked by some youths, like, what do you think is the biggest problem in today's world? And he said, the biggest problem that we face in today's world is crooked thinking. Crooked thinking, that's the biggest problem that we face. So he gave loads of examples. So for example, he said, there's somebody driving a taxi, but they've got a degree, they've got a master's, and they'll be complaining, I've got a doctorate, I've got, I don't know, this diploma and stuff, but I'm having to ride a taxi. He said, well, this is crooked thinking. Who said that this job is beneath you? You convinced yourself it's beneath you. Did the prophets and imams not do jobs which were beneath them, and yet they never considered them to be beneath them? You know, they were farmers, they were carpenters, they were sheep herders. Mm-hmm. Imam Ali alayhi salam used to dig wells and stuff. If anyone should be complaining about having a higher educational position, it's the Ahlul Bayt. And yet they loved to do that kind of work.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, One of his companions saw him with sweat and he was burning in the sun and he was working the land. And he said, I love to see a servant in this condition. So it's crooked thinking. Somebody wants to get married. A youth wants to get married, but they say, oh, okay, no, not until I have this much in the bank, until I have a house, until I have
Until I reach the perfection and then I will get married.
Her sister doesn't adopt hijab because she says, I'm not perfect enough yet. I'm not good enough yet. Oh, it would be hypocrisy if I did that. It's crooked thinking. Yeah. So many other things, you know. Mm-hmm. There's so many examples that
we justify
countless
things with our logic without noticing about the true thing. We put the truth aside and then we start justification.
It's illogical. And he said that the cure for all these problems, even if you look at the tyrannical governments of the world, mm-hmm. or you look at evildoers, somebody's mean to you, somebody's rude to you in the streets. Why were they rude to you? Why did they steal from you? Why are these bad things? They're all crooked thinkers. That's mm-hmm. really what it comes down to. Yes, yeah. Those crooked thoughts are manifesting through their actions, but it really goes back to their thoughts, the way that they're thinking. And he said the solution to all of these problems is one thing, and that is اِهْدِنَا الصِّرَاطَ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ.
That's the guideline.
Guide us to the right path. Yeah. And that really affected my prayers because now I'm like, okay, every time I'm saying اِهْدِنَا الصِّرَاطَ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ, oh Allah, guide me to the straight path, I'm actually saying it about my thoughts.
Yeah.
Between this dhuhr prayer that I'm praying and maghrib, I need to be able to think correctly about where I am, what I'm doing, or what's coming my way.
Exactly.
You know, and that would actually solve everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you say that for every single thing we need a guide, and I'm just with you because, as I just told you, we would turn into tiny creatures if we follow only our intellect because it is not complete. It's no way for any human being who could say that I'm complete in every sort of knowledge or whatever. And every time I just talk about knowledge, I just remember Dr. Faustus, who sold his entire existence for more of knowledge and for more of things that he wanted to have. But that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
See, you can never get the complete knowledge if you're not going to follow the path of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we need their guideline, we need their guidance, and we have to think about every single action that we take in order to be according to what Allah wants us to be.
Oh, that's all we have time for today. I think we got somewhere, alhamdulillah. From myself and from sister, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Reports say a proposed bill in the U.S. state of New England would see prisoners trade their organs for a reduced sentence. This shameful and controversial bill is another step in America's descent into a horror story of late-stage capitalism that one might dub vampiric and where the wealthy feed on the blood of the poor. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to the website of RT, state legislatures around the United States are keenly watching the fate of a Massachusetts bill allowing prisoners to receive up to 1 year off their jail sentence by donating their organs. According to reports, Bill HD 3822, called the Act to Establish the Massachusetts Incarcerated Individual Bone Marrow and Organ Donation Program, would allow participating prisoners to receive a minimum of 60 days and up to a whole year of their sentence. It would be set up in a special parole hearing based similarly on commuted sentences for good behavior. However, it would also encourage repeat donations, and since those incarcerated in the U.S. are disproportionately minorities and low-income earners, it bears similarities to the country's blood and plasma donation scheme. That system preys on low-income earners and students, encouraging them to consistently donate their blood at for-profit collection centers, effectively selling it in a sort of vampiric version of capitalism. In a 2019 piece titled Harvesting the Blood of America's Poor, the Latest Stage of Capitalism, Alan McLeod observed that around 130 million Americans admit an inability to pay for basic needs like food, housing, or healthcare. Buying and selling blood is one of the few booming industries America has left. The number of collection centers in the United States has more than doubled since 2005, and blood now makes up well over 2% of total U.S. exports by value. To put that in perspective, Americans' blood is now worth more than all exported corn or soy products that cover vast areas of the country's heartland, he said. According to McLeod, the U.S. supplies fully 70% of the world's plasma, mainly because most other countries have banned the practice on ethical and medical grounds. Exports increased by over 13% to $28.6 billion between 2016 and 2017, and the plasma market is projected to grow radiantly, according to one industry report. The majority goes to wealthy European countries. Germany, for example, buys 15% of all U.S. blood exports. Other countries like Japan are also key customers. But low-incomers giving blood for money is a very different scenario from prisoners literally giving their organs for freedom. The most important difference is that the proposed organ donations by prisoners would be the result of a criminal penalty. The U.S. Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment of convicts, and one could argue this makes the bill unconstitutional. But the way it is framed means the organ for freedom contract is not technically a punishment, but simply a voluntary system that can reduce a convict's actual punishment. Neither is it necessarily cruel, since a person can live a normal everyday life without a kidney, nor unusual, because healthy people donate organs all the time. The United States has slavery as a form of punishment codified in its constitution via the 13th Amendment. It is also a country where the death penalty is legal at the federal level, but mainly implemented by states in capital offenses such as murder. U.S. prisons also routinely implement long-term solitary confinement, recognized by the UN as a form of torture. The threshold to prove cruel and unusual punishment is thus exceptionally high. One of the primary arguments put forward by proponents of the bill is that prisoners have no way, as of now, to donate organs even if they choose to. That is a pretty sound case. After all, shouldn't they be able to exercise that right if everyone else has it? And what's the argument against them losing this right, especially if it helps everyone, including Massachusetts' jammed up donor waiting list? Unfortunately, the easily foreseen problem is that it incentivizes people to literally give up organs, parts of their bodies, for their freedom. This is inherently immoral. The people locked up in U.S. prisons are disproportionately from minority groups, subject to awful conditions, with little access to economic aid or rehabilitation. This is one of the main reasons why the U.S. has the highest recidivism rate in the world, with 76% of prisoners released being rearrested within 5 years, and an astonishing 44% returning to prison within only 1 year. The entire system is set up for failure and for people to return to prison, thus pushing them to donate their organs, but without any financial compensation, only a reduced sentence.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-computing. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-computing in the Islamic lifestyle in order to have the self-reformation. Now, after we have the self-determination and the, you know, the meditation, it is time to have the self-computing, have some calculations about ourselves, to analyze our own selves. And this self-computing means that every day before we sleep in the night, we need to think about the actions that we have performed during the day. If I want to have an Islamic lifestyle, I must calculate, I must compute myself, I must analyze my routine in that day, that what I have performed, what I have done, was it in line with the teachings of Islam? Was it according to the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam? Or it was something else? And if I'm talking about the teachings of the Quran and the Prophet, it should be in a way that if I am in a non-Muslim society, the way they have taught me to live in a non-Muslim society, am I living like that? If it is in the Muslim society, am I living according to what it's been taught to be in the Muslim society? For example, we can look at the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam before he migrated to Medina. how he lived amongst the kuffar and mushrikeen, how he used to live amongst the pagans and the polytheists and the disbelievers. So his life when he was there in Mecca, how he was, because he was living amongst the mushrikeen, he was living amongst the pagans. And everyone has witnessed that he was the most truthful person. He was sadiq, and he was the most trustworthy person. He never lied to people. He was the best of ethics amongst the people, and people used to love him and believe in him. Even if he would lie, they would think that this is the truth. So basically, the life, the way he had, do we have the same life or not? Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-computing in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that it is necessary to basically analyze our life on the daily basis, and every day before we go to sleep, before we go to bed, we need to analyze ourselves that when I spend a day, was it in accordance with the teachings? And I just gave that example before the break that if we are living in a non-Muslim country, we need to look at the life of the Prophet, which he was living before the Islam, like amongst the kuffar and mushrikeen, how he was basically. And when we need to look at the lifestyle which we are having in the Muslim country, we need to see his life in Medina, how he used to deal with the Muslims, how he used to deal with the brothers in Iman, with the mu'mineen, and how he was living his life. Therefore, on the daily basis, we need to analyze ourselves. We need to have self-analysis that, am I living such a life or not? For example, during the day, if I have committed a sin, am I ready to repent to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at the end of the night and ask for forgiveness and promise him not to repeat the same sin the next day, because my everyday should be different from the previous, and every day I need to advance. It should be different in advancement, like I need to advance every day, which is different from the previous day. If I was unable to perform something in the previous day, I should do it, or in the current day, I should do it tomorrow. I should go towards that. Therefore, it is necessary to look for myself. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even in the Quran, has said in the chapter 29, verse 69, that وَالَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينَا, those who struggle in our path, those who struggle for us, means that who struggle to live or to have an Islamic lifestyle, لَنَهْدِيَنَّهُمْ سُبُلَنَا, definitely, we will guide them towards our path. وَإِنَّ اللَّهَ مَعَ الْمُحْسِنِينَ, and certainly Allah is definitely with the good doers, doers of good, with the muhsineen, the doers of good, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador and governor of South Carolina, is planning to announce a presidential run. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Washington Post has covered this story and tells us more. Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador and governor of South Carolina, is planning to announce that she will run for president, positioning herself to be the first declared Republican challenger to Donald Trump, at a time when other prospective candidates have slowed their moves. Nikki Haley could release a video signaling her decision as soon as this week, a strategy, as described by multiple people briefed on the plans who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk publicly, intended to drive attendance and enthusiasm for an in-person announcement event in the coming weeks. Haley plans to officially announce her run in Charleston, South Carolina, on 15th of February, according to one person briefed on the plans, a date first reported by the Post and Courier newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina. Some political advisers have been relocating to the Charleston area for the campaign. Nikki Haley's decision to lean into the race bucks the more cautious strategy adopted by most other potential candidates, who have decided there is no need to rush their preparations. Advisers to these Republicans, many of whom spoke on condition of anonymity, described private conversations, said there is a wariness about becoming an early target of former President Donald Trump. Some of the advisers also voiced hope that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has made preliminary moves towards a run, faces early scrutiny because of his high national polling, scrutiny that could work to their advantage. They added that there is a general sense in their circles that there is enough time to learn more about how the race will play out and still attract donors, get on ballots and build campaign infrastructure. There's no benefit to being in early, said David Urban, a former Trump advisor who is friendly with multiple would-be 2024 candidates. Urban added, you don't want to be in the ring getting banged on by the former president in a one-on-one. There's no reason anyone has to get in right now. There's no urgency for anyone. Everyone is sitting and waiting. Much of the consequential action in the race so far has taken place in private conversations and strategy sessions rather than early state barnstorms, such as methodical preparation by aides to former Vice President Mike Pence and Ron DeSantis advisors behind-the-scenes moves to identify potential staff and plan travel. Even Donald Trump has moved slowly after his early announcement. The former president hit the trail this past week for the first time since launching his campaign in November, promising a campaign about the future and about issues, even as he returned to some old grievances, falsely telling Republicans in New Hampshire that he won two general elections, a reference to his claims of victory in 2020. Some Republican leaders have urged the party to move on and view the former president as politically weakened after disappointing midterm elections in which Donald Trump's endorsed candidates lost key races. One question that looms over the jockeying for position is where wealthy Republican donors will decide to put their money. Some major donors who were with Donald Trump in 2020 have not yet committed to his re-election, even after entreaties from Donald Trump advisers. As one advisor to a major GOP donor put it, I don't think anybody in our world has picked a horse yet. CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. Nikki Haley, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and South Carolina governor, is expected to officially announce her 2024 presidential run on 15th of February in Charleston, South Carolina, according to two South Carolina Republicans familiar with her plans. Nikki Haley would become the first Republican candidate to join former President Donald Trump in the Republican presidential primary. Haley's last hint at a 2024 run came earlier this month during a Fox News interview in which she called for generational change when looking at the future of the country. I don't think you need to be 80 years old to be a leader in Washington, D.C., the 51-year-old Nikki Haley said. I think we need a younger generation to come in, step up, and really start fixing things. When you're looking at a run for president, you look at two things, Haley added. You first look at, does the current situation push for new leadership? The second question is, am I that person and could be that, and could I be that new leader? So do I think I could be that leader? Yes, but we're still working through things and we'll figure it out. I've never lost a race. I said that then. I still say it now. I'm not going to lose now. In the 2022 midterm election cycle, though her Stand for America PAC, Nikki Haley campaigned for Republicans up and down the ticket and took trips to Iowa, to New Hampshire and to Nevada, all early presidential primary states. She was also a close surrogate on the trail of Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and Senate candidates Dr. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania and Herschel Walker in Georgia. Nikki Haley has consistently polled third or fourth in early 2024 GOP primary surveys. In a Trafalgar Group poll in late January of South Carolina primary voters, Nikki Haley was placed fourth and got 11.6% of the vote in a field that included Donald Trump, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, South Carolina Governor Tim Scott, former Vice President Mike Pence, and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Tim Scott, another potential 2024 contender from the Palmetto State, is traveling to Iowa for the Polk County Republican Party's annual Lincoln Dinner in late February. Nikki Haley stepped from the governor's office to the international stage at the United Nations, rounding out credentials that would prepare her for a campaign like this. It's like a countdown at NASA, T-minus 2 weeks and counting, said Dave Wilson, president of the Christian nonprofit Palmetto Family Council. Nikki Haley notched one symbolic win against Donald Trump last year in the primary for South Carolina's first congressional district, when Haley backed Representative Nancy Mace. Nancy Mace defeated Donald Trump's endorsed candidate, former Representative Katie Arrington, by about 9 percentage points. Trump told reporters traveling with him on Saturday to South Carolina for a campaign stop that Nikki Haley had reached out to her ex-boss to inform him that she was considering running for the White House. She called me and said she would like to consider it, and I said, you should do it, Trump recounted. I talked to her for a little while. I said, look, you know, go by your heart if you want to run. Nikki Haley, a South Carolina native who was the first female and Indian-American governor in state history, told the Associated Press in April of 2021 that she would not challenge Donald Trump if he decided to run again. Trump nominated Haley for the United Nations ambassadorship after his win in 2016. I would not run if President Trump ran, and I would talk to him about it, Nikki Haley said at the time. But since then, she has suggested repeatedly that she is seriously considering a run. The former South Carolina governor told Fox News Channel that her comments about not running against Donald Trump were made before some perceived flaws of President Joe Biden's administration, such as the withdrawal from Afghanistan and a dramatic rise in inflation. IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists, and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamu alayha. Some signs bring depression. They make people depressed. They discourage people. They are different. Some signs lead people towards sins. Many of the signs that are set to instrumental music are like this. Each of these songs has some music at the start of it that inspires the singer with the song. These songs are often not appropriate. We need to be careful about the poems we recite, the songs we sing, and the elegies we read, whether they are about a tragedy or when we beat our chest, or whether it is sung in praise. We need to make sure we do not combine them with these things. This is an important point to note. I urge you to pay attention to this. Therefore, the content must be good. The structure of the poem should be good. The framework, body, appearance of the poem must be good. This will raise your audience's level of thinking.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you put the best topics in a weak poem and read it, its effect will be greatly reduced. Allow your audience's mind to become accustomed to rich literature. This will help the intellectual growth of the society. In a similar meeting a few years ago, I referred to some of Sa'ib's ghazals, which were not ghazals on love. They were ghazals on wisdom, and they were filled with wisdom. The poetry is extremely rich and beautiful. It is good to look for those poems and read them. Thankfully, some poets write some very good poems in this field. In addition to gaining understanding in elegies, there is also stirring of emotions. This is also an important point. There is gaining understanding. This means that you are teaching people with the poem you are reciting. Many of the things we learn are from the elegies that elegists recite, things that we have already told others many times in a simple language. But when the elegist or eulogist recites the same thing with a good voice and a good melody, it is as though we are hearing, understanding, and learning something new.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. God. guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The closing session of the ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.
Agriculture, exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Solat Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Makamura Shava, said mutual ties with Iran is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Pakistanis take to the streets across the country on Kashmir Solidarity Day to condemn what they call the illegal occupation of Jammu and Kashmir regions by India. The rallies were held along with a host of events, including conferences and seminars, attended by senior government officials and lawmakers in such major cities